And now it is time for us to get started. Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to emforum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today. We are very glad you could join us, and for our newcomers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. Today's topic is the Christchurch earthquake that struck New Zealand earlier this year. Our guest happened to be a member of a delegation that was visiting at the time and had the opportunity to observe the impacts firsthand. But first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with a presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. Now, if you have any difficulty with live meeting, you can use the feedback drop-down menu up here at the top right. Oops, get my pointer going. To change your color to indicate that you need assistance. And then my associates, Ava Jean Moore or Lori Weber, will try to assist you. And then once you have been helped, please do change your color back to green. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. And we also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or moderator, as we will be busy. We are making a recording, which should be available later this week. And we are also trying something new. Due to popular demand, we are making an audio-only MP3 version of our programs, starting with the last one. You will be able to access directly from our website or by subscribing to a podcast now available from the iTunes store. And then the text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you're not on a mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you'll get a notice and links when these materials are ready. Now, it is my privilege to introduce today's special guest. Timothy W. Manning has been FEMA's Deputy Administrator for Protection and National Preparedness for the past 2 years. And prior to joining FEMA, Mr. Manning served as the Secretary of the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management and as Homeland Security Advisor to Governor Richardson. As a former firefighter, EMT, rescue mountaineer, hazardous materials specialist, and hydrologist, he brings almost 2 decades of diverse frontline emergency management experience to the agency. Please do see today's background page for further information and related links. Welcome, Tim. We are honored to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking the time to share your perspectives today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I much appreciate it.
And I turn the floor over to you to get us started, please.
Great. All right. Thank you. And welcome, everybody. It's good to virtually talk to you all. Over the next few minutes, I'm going to just run through a brief presentation, and I look forward to the conversation and answering any questions you all might have. What I'm going to talk about today is simply my very, very small part in the first week that unfolded after the Christchurch earthquake back in February. I'm going to be giving my perspective as the perspective of a professional emergency manager who finds himself caught as one of the survivors of an event, and what I witnessed and what I saw of the events and some takeaways and lessons that I learned that I think we could all consider in how we go about our business of emergency management here in the U.S. and anywhere else. I'm not going to comment on any of the response on the part of the City of Christchurch or Canterbury or New Zealand or any of the other parties there, other than to say I witnessed some of the most dedicated and tireless professionals in any response I've ever been part of. It was an honor and privilege to be able to help in whatever little way I could, and I'll remember the selflessness and the risk that people put themselves at constantly forever. So it's my pleasure there, and especially the work of Mayor Parker and Prime Minister Key and all of the, well, just everybody there. So let's go through real quick here, and bear with me as I learn, see if I can manage technology. And I believe First one is reloading. Great. Start with a little bit of background on the actual earthquake itself, and this will have some importance and bearing in some of the recommendations or lessons learned. The slide here is on the left is a USGS, it's pager. This is a combination of all of the information and model runs that the USGS throws out pretty quickly when there's an earthquake event. And as you can see, make some prediction as to the severity of the damage. And so that particular earthquake, moment magnitude 6.3, happened just after lunch on the 22nd of February at 12:51. And that's across the date line, so a lot of the stuff you'll see in the U.S. had it as a different date. Very shallow earthquake, 3.1-mile depth. A Mercalli of 8, you see parenthetically I've got a 10-plus because it is, I think, as an aggregate across the city, probably an 8, but there were areas well in exceedance of that in the moment magnitude, or in the Mercalli scale. A little bit, some tsunamis generated on inland lakes. And the these are numbers as of a month ago or so, with 166 confirmed dead, but there were another 200 missing at the time, and I know those numbers have been updated, and over 2,000 injured. Let's see if we move to the next slide here. And you know, New Zealand is at the border of the Australian plate and the Pacific plate around the Ring of Fire. Most of you are probably well familiar with the global, you know, the geotectonic structure of the Earth and why things happen where they happen. But earthquakes can happen anywhere in the world. They happen mid-plate. Severe earthquakes happen mid-plate from time to time as well, but they are very common along the plate boundaries. And here at the boundary of the Australian and Pacific plates, we have a subduction zone boundary that will bear in, come to be part of this in a little while. You'll see also the subduction of the Pacific plate into the Eurasian plate is where we see damage from the Tokyo earthquake as well. And if there are any of my colleagues or my seismological colleagues on the call, I'll offer my apologies as just a plain old geologist. It offers me the ability to pronounce many of the words correctly, but often maybe not in a way that the seismologist would always appreciate. So I'll offer that right now. Let's go to the next slide. There's for context, where Christchurch, New Zealand lies on the South Island of New Zealand, up at the top here, you actually can't see my pointer, but at the top of the South Island, you'll see the Cook Straits and where across the Cook Straits from Wellington, capital of New Zealand. Ah, there's a dot. And the where most seismologists, geologists, and emergency managers assumed that a catastrophic earthquake would occur. Here's a view of Christchurch itself. The epicenter of this particular quake was just below Lyttelton, in a suburb there. You'll see at the bottom of the landmass in the bay, on the north end of that bay. This is this area is all from downtown Christchurch to Lyttelton is only about a 20-minute drive to give you an idea of distances. One last throw to the geologists. This particular earthquake, a strike slips fault with, a strike slips fault with oblique reverse thrust movement, which means not a simple movement of side to side or up and down, but a kind of transverse movement down and off to the side. Moment magnitude 6.3. Just a moment, please. Okay. Moment magnitude 6.3, but an important thing, a peak ground acceleration in the central business district of 1.8 G, right over the epicenter 2.2 G. I'll talk about that here in a second as well. This particular earthquake, while only a moment magnitude 6.3, had such high ground acceleration, there was so much shaking involved, it was well in exceedance of anything anybody expected here. And frankly, up until this earthquake, hadn't seen anywhere else. We hadn't recorded that PGA anywhere else on Earth up until this earthquake. And up until a week later, this was the largest peak ground acceleration ever measured in an earthquake anywhere on Earth. That was superseded then a week later by Japan, the Sendai earthquake with 2.9 G. And this is a, you guys want to, if everybody wants to take a close look at this, this is just a quick glance at some of the larger earthquakes, and you'll see the 2011 Christchurch earthquake at 2.2 G at 6.3. As opposed to the, you look down a little bit further, the 2010 Canterbury earthquake, which was the September earthquake, that was a 7.1, much more energy released as a moment magnitude scale, but down at 1.26 G. Most earthquakes around the world, building codes anyway, and all of our planning criteria are based around 0.5 G, which is the statistically the most likely and most common earthquake. You'll see the Haiti 2010-80 earthquake with close to 300,000 dead only had a peak ground acceleration of about 0.5 G. You see some of these others as well. The Kobe earthquake, everyone's familiar with 0.8 G. The Northridge earthquake, a bit higher here, 1994, 1.7 G, but all of that paling is when you get up to 2.2 G, and a reason for, one of the reasons for so much of the damage that seemed well in exceedance of any of the damage that occurred, and certainly the number of lives lost in a what would on its surface look like a much bigger earthquake back in September prior. This is a shot, a very lucky shot somebody took on a hillside between Littleton, I think, and downtown Christchurch at the moment of the quake. It's the dust rising from downtown. So there's the background of where we were. Now, I mentioned I happened to be in Christchurch. I was there on behalf of Secretary Napolitano and the administration as part of the U.S.-New Zealand Partnership Forum discussing a number of issues in global trade security and homeland security issues, as well as some emergency preparedness, and had even just the day before had a lengthy meeting with Mayor Parker and his people on their experiences from the September 7.1 earthquake, which fortunately happened early in the morning while most people were at home, and there were no deaths as a result of that earthquake. That day, 22nd of February, the meeting had wrapped up. I was at the airport with a number of other people, not together, a number of people from the group were leaving to go on the follow-on meetings. I was on my way to Wellington. The rest of the group were spread out around the city. I'll just take a quick moment here as you're looking at the international terminal of the New Zealand, of the Christchurch Airport, and commend the building codes and the adherence of the building codes in Christchurch. It was a tragic loss of life on that day, but it could have been much, much greater if the buildings hadn't been built as strong as they are. This is just a few of the people that were at the closest point to the building after we had evacuated. This is in the moments after the main shock of that day, prior to the first of the major aftershocks, which was, as I recall, I think a 6.0 or 5.9 or something. And I'll also draw your attention to the see if I can do this. Just select the pointer tool and hold down the left mouse button. And if I can do that. Yeah, this little red dot here as I went around here. This is something you would have seen all around Christchurch, construction, remodeling, and rebuilding from the damage from the earlier earthquake. And this is going to play a larger part in the response here over the next 24 to 48 hours. Immediately after the first quake and the evacuation, some of the Christchurch, the New Zealand police that were assigned to the airport were listening to the radio traffic and trying to get through. And as we've all experienced in big emergencies, that radio traffic was completely saturated. So unable to reach their dispatch or any of their colleagues, they stood up on the bumper of their car and yelled into the crowd if there were any doctors, nurses, firefighters, anybody willing to go back to the Central Business District to help in response to what sounded like horrific damage. So this is a number of people came forward, including all those construction workers. There was a scene that was replayed over and over again across the city that with their tools, grabbed their tools or tool belts and jumped in, and apologies to anybody who might be pictured in any of these photos. These were snapped with my BlackBerry as we were going through that day. I don't have releases from anyone, so please take a look at this, but don't use any of these photos. the person in the foreground here is a former Navy nurse, as I recall, and then there were some other doctors and nurses along for the ride. We commandeered a shuttle bus to the remote parking. The driver was nice enough to agree with the police to drive us back to the central business district. Of course, the roads were completely jammed, and so that's Pedro. I never did get his last name. The police officer who took us all, and another woman named Wendy, never got her last name either, who was on her first day as a rookie police officer at the airport going to her new assignment in Auckland from her home here in Christchurch. So without lights or sirens or anything on a saturated road, he ran from the airport back downtown, down the middle of the road like that, banging on car windows, telling people to get out of the way. And it worked until we picked up a police escort. And you can see some of the road damages were going in. As we arrived in the central business district, this was probably about 15 to 20 minutes after the 20, maybe half an hour after the main shock. We worked our way through the downtown, and you know, you can see some of the damage as we're starting to get in to the downtown area. Here you'll see Christchurch. The River Avon runs all through Christchurch, winds its way around. There are bridges everywhere. As you can imagine, a coastal city, every one of the bridges was buckled and or collapsed, making getting around the city virtually impossible. This is one example right by the Headley Park going into downtown. An example of one of the, you know, we talked about the acceleration and the damage in Haiti where, you know, building codes are non-existent and adherence, obviously, you can't adhere to something that doesn't even exist. This is the Pine Gold Guinness building, a new building, I think less than 25 years old, completely pancaked in the quake. Built and adhered to the building codes, designed to standard. I'm sure there are engineering forensics that are happening to figure out how and why this happened, but this was one example of a modern building that should have been able to survive a 6.3 earthquake, obviously not coming close. But we'll talk more about the difference between moment magnitude and acceleration in a bit. This is another picture. After working with the construction workers and nurses, we kind of went through and dropped off volunteers as we went at collapsed buildings to nurses and doctors to help as we went through and did a hasty search of the central business district looking for survivors and people who needed help and then dropping off people along the way. Finally ending up here at the Pine Gold building, helping. There were survivors in this building calling for help and calling out on cell phones and sending text messages that they were trapped in here. So the group I was with stopped here to stop their work through the city to concentrate on this building here, another shot of the Pine Gold building. And I'll talk about this again later as one of the lessons learned. But I think we all understand in a catastrophic disaster, our resources will be saturated. And I want to just draw attention to amongst the just unbelievable work that was being done by Christchurch Fire and the New Zealand Police. If you take a close look at this building, you'll see this is what was a six, I think, story modern building at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a business day full of people. And this is, I think this photo is taken, well, this is, at this point, I might actually be one of those dots on the ground there. This is probably about an hour and a half to 2 hours after the main shock. And you'll see one fire truck, one ladder truck there, and one police car you can identify. That red car up in the corner there is the car of an off-duty police officer. And that's it. The majority of the people you see that you can pick out on that building are actually bystanders and construction workers that are saving people. And that night that I ran into later, ran into Pedro again on my way out of town a week later, and he tells me they were there until about 3 in the morning, that construction crew, and rescued, I think if I remember right, 23 people from inside the rubble that day. It's about this point that I connected with the embassy and a New Zealand police officer who I had been with at the forum earlier in that week, and we went to the command post at at City Hall to connect with Mayor Parker and offer any assistance we could. So here's a couple, a quick sequence of before and after shots with a nod to Google Earth, Google Maps anyway, and Street View. I was able to go back and find the spots we were at later. So here's before and after, the same block, same street. Remember, I thought this was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The streets were full, the street sidewalks were full of people going to lunch, coming back from lunch, going to work. Traffic, obviously, driving down the street. Before and after the same block. The hotel in this building in the background is the Meridian. This is Meridian. This is the hotel that I was staying in, actually. This view up off the frame. Survived with very little damage, actually, a modern, so that's a good study as well. That same block, the restaurant that I was going to have lunch in, actually, but decided not to. Another before and after, and you'll see that this this entire building on the corner is now missing in the after shot. And this street here is the main pedestrian mall of the city center. This was full of people as well. Let's go to the next. There we go. Another modern hotel building that didn't fare as well, this is the Grand Chancellor Hotel. This is about a 20 to 30-story building. And this photo may not do it as much justice, but that's leaning at about a 10 to 20-degree lean. And it's kind of leaning into the foreground of this photo. This was during when we were walking block to block, and we looked up and realized that this thing was about to come down on us. And then, so I took the best shot I could because I had my BlackBerry in my hand, and then we moved very quickly. Far away. There were a large number of people in this, you can see here and here, and some of these broken windows are people having broken out the window and were flagging down, flagging for help, waving sheets. And on the street, on this side of the street, were actually a couple police officers with some spray paint they had found that had written in about 10-foot letters on the street in spray paint, "Stay where you are," trying to keep them from doing like what this guy's doing here. There was a, I ran into later, this is a different building in the upper shot than the Grand Chancellor, but this scene replayed itself. I had run into somebody who was actually on the 27th floor, I think, of the Grand Chancellor building at the time, and he told me in great detail the story of he and all the people that were trapped above. What happened was obviously the elevators failed, and the staircase out of this building disappeared. It's on the back side here, and the entire stairwell collapsed. So they were trapped on the upper side of the building. There were frequent, every couple of minutes, where it was a +5 aftershock, and some even bigger. Entire buildings were coming down at this moment when this photo was taken around us here. I think just a minute before or after one of these buildings came into the street. And he described how they eventually, they considered taking hose from the fire hose in the hall and trying to rappel down the windows and realized that might work in the movies, but they weren't possibly strong enough to do that. So in the end, they kind of just picked their way down as close as they could and then waited for help. Some additional damage. Now, a lot of this, you'll see, on a lot of photos, you'll see these fences around places. These fences, this probably resulted in uncounted lives saved. There was a lot of damage from the September earthquake. Now, this church, for example, this is part of, I think, actually the University of Christchurch or Christchurch College, had a lot of damage but hadn't collapsed. And any building that got red tagged had these fences erected around it out much further than one would expect at what they predicted would be the collapse areas. It was all over downtown Christchurch. And when the buildings did collapse, even some that weren't damaged in the September quake, there were people, there were areas that you couldn't have been walking in. Now this, on the other hand, a lot of the deaths actually occurred from people being caught in the street and facades collapsing on them, as well as buildings coming down on top of people who were there. These are some more of the damage. The CTV building was another tragedy. This is another modern building that was built to code and shouldn't have had the impact it did. The entire thing pancaked and then burned. A number of people trapped there for a while, and another tragedy. These are some examples of liquefaction. This is a thing we talk about a lot in earthquake preparedness and response, but very few people ever have seen it or really understand what it means when it happens. If you look closely at this photo, it'll look like any flood you've ever seen, but the difference is that's not a flood. That's liquefaction. That's the ground turning liquid, boiling up through the concrete and asphalt. And essentially what you're looking at there, aside from the river, aside from the Avon here, these up here, all of this in here is actually sand, liquefied at this moment, it looks like, from the reflections, but rapidly turning back solid and like quicksand at this point in this consistency. Getting through the city was a challenge, as you can imagine and as you'll see. This is a shot of the meeting we had was at the Christchurch rugby pitch where they were going to have the Rugby World Cup. And there's another after of the liquefaction, just kind of the ground turning to liquid. That's a fairly dramatic example of where a sinkhole opened up, liquefaction, car drove in, car doesn't drive out. This particular photo was taken, I believe, off of news. Few of these were grabs from news sites. Most of them are my own, but this is one that you can find various angles of through an internet search. A happy coincidence of planning, the New Zealand or Canterbury or Christchurch, I'm not sure what scale it was, but there was a botanical garden show opening, and they had erected this very, very large tent facility. On top of the earthquake, the weather that day was about 40 degrees and raining, between 40 and 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and pouring rain all day. So sheltering all of the thousands of people displaced from the apartments and hotels in the central business district, not to mention the people whose homes were destroyed, was, of course, the big concern. And the earthquake happening right at 1, and New Zealand being fairly south from the equator, you know, darkness came quickly, and it was a race to get the sheltering identified and opened. And so this was commandeered and turned into the first of the big mass congregate shelters. Everybody involved did a stellar job of pulling together. There weren't, at one point it was identified, there weren't enough cots and blankets in New Zealand available for all of the people who were displaced on that first night, although it was accounted for very quickly. This is a shot of Littleton, not too far away, when after that first 2 days, or actually about that first 20 hours, I was able to find the rest of the crew from the U.S. Embassy and spent the rest of the week helping get U.S. government aid to New Zealand and to the city of Christchurch and trying to find any U.S. citizens who needed assistance. And later in the week, we ended up going to some of these outlying cities to try to find people who needed help. Another before and after, this is the art gallery that's attached to City Hall. It's actually next door, and it's part of the same complex. They built this with great foresight, not intending to be resilient to disasters, but getting there in the process as self-sustaining. They get their power, they get their gas from the landfill pipe directly into this facility. Their water comes from catchment on the roof, and their electricity comes from cogeneration from that gas and other power sources. They're off. It spins the meter backwards off the grid, and it was the only place with power and light, briefly running water, and then the entire city's water, the sewer system shut down. So they had water that would come in, but it couldn't go out. So we had to bring in facilities, obviously. So this is the welcome ceremony from the partnership forum, and then after the art museum was commandeered, or the art gallery was commandeered as the city operations center. An amazing facility built almost entirely of glass, very little of which broke during the earthquake. This was another study in structural engineering that should be looked at. They didn't lose a single pane of glass in the 7.1 in September, and they were very proud of that. Of course, there was a lot more damage in this one. Some hanging fixtures had to be removed. That's what this tape is about. So a number of people just falling in and doing what is necessary. I said I wouldn't comment much about how the city and the country did their operation, but let me again say the level of dedication, professionalism, and calm was like nothing I've seen. It was extremely impressive. All of these people, obviously had worked together in the September earthquake, but nothing like this, with this amount of damage, this amount of search and rescue to do, and this amount of people to be sheltered. It was handled quickly and calmly, and most impressively. The expected media started descending pretty quickly. This is obviously a few days later, after 24-hour operations, where one thing, this being a commandeered art gallery, there wasn't the computer infrastructure that one would associate with an EOC, so everything was largely done by telephone, by cellular telephone in hand and paper. But it goes to the training, the requirement, the need for training, and really understanding not just how to use a particular system, but why do you do it that way, so that when it doesn't work, you can do it anyway. So what are the main lessons that, you know, having been, for the first couple hours, simply just another survivor, but albeit one, a geologist and an emergency manager, so I had an understanding of what's going on. And then a couple of days as a first responder, and then a few more days as a observing a disaster from the outside as part of a foreign delegation team. Let me run through a couple of these. So I had heard a few times talking to colleagues and people in New Zealand just about earthquakes, and especially even in that week, was that nobody was hurt in that 7.0, so you know we can handle that. It's not a big deal, and Wellington is really the concern. That earthquake in Christchurch was kind of an aberration, and it released all the energy. It probably won't be a big deal, but what's the important takeaway is that we can't ever assume anything like that. It's, you know, in our line of work, we have to presume that and plan for the possibility that these things can happen, and they're not always going to be as easy as the last time. Now, that previous earthquake being, like I said, a 7.0, 7.1, depending on which reports, a lot more energy, moment magnitude. There's 33% more energy released every time you make a jump there. It's a logarithmic scale. But the distance and geology and geomorphology and those things all matter a lot. And what's probably a lot more relevant for us as emergency managers than understanding the amount of energy released in an earthquake by paying attention to the moment magnitude and/or, you know, if it's an early solution or an older solution, you know, Richter number, is the ground acceleration or Mercalli, because they do covariate fairly well. Because ground acceleration means how fast stuff is moving, how violent the shaking is, and how much damage there is. The 6.3 was orders of magnitude more catastrophic, more damaging than the 7.1, because that peak ground acceleration was so much higher, and because the geology, the subsurface geology, is different than maybe we assumed, because that earthquake was shallower and a lot closer. Those things make a lot of difference and probably require a lot more attention to us from us than anything else. Building codes matter. I'm talking to you today because of good building codes. There are 300 or so souls lost in that earthquake, but there could have, and frankly from what I saw, should have been a lot more than that. And it's a testament to the building codes and the adherence to the building codes, the enforcement. My biggest takeaway is that the public are first responders. And that's something, I shouldn't have needed this, and I know that, I know better, and I think we all know better. In my time as a firefighter, is my time on the street, in the field, I can't really recall a scene that I pulled up on that there wasn't somebody already trying to help. And we as a profession spend probably too much time planning for limiting spontaneous volunteers. How quickly can we set up cordons and exclusion zones? And that is all important. But we cannot neglect the public. The survivors are responders. They need to be part of the response. We here at FEMA are changing the way we think about the way we plan and the way we think about our responses, because the first people to render aid are the people that survived the incident and are standing right there. I don't have any statistics for this other than what I saw personally over the course of 24 hours and then over the next week, but I wouldn't be surprised if the majority, the large majority of people who were received aid immediately and were rescued in the first hours from the rubble and probably lives saved from either being trapped for too long or hypothermia or anything else were rescued by bystanders and rescued by construction workers. The fire services, EMS, they focused their expertise, their specialized equipment, specialized training on the really hard cases, the people. One of the doctors I was with, one of the first doctors that left the group I was with, went off to perform a field amputation on somebody that wouldn't have been rescued otherwise. We should be planning around focusing our efforts like that, and embracing the fact that the public will put their lives at risk to help each other. Those construction workers, not just the ones that we brought from the airport, but the hundreds that we picked up along the way and ran into around corners, they had survived in large cases, a number that I was with for about an hour and a half, by seconds. They had literally stepped off the scaffold to get lunch as the ground started shaking and that building and that collapsed onto that scaffolding at an intersection we were at when we came back around. By seconds, those guys that had been up there would not have been walking around. They would not have survived that. And in the seconds after that, they went right back into the rubble in the midst of aftershocks. And, continued aftershocks and building collapses to try to rescue others. Is our advice correct? Don't go outside. We say don't run outside in an earthquake. Well, that, generally speaking, that's correct. But a lot of people, and I saw buildings that had collapsed on people that had they gone outside, they may have survived. I'm not saying that we shouldn't, that we should change that, but we owe it to ourselves to think hard about this. Aftershocks kill. This was, geologists will tell you, an aftershock to the 7.0. Regardless, there were aftershocks to this main quake that dropped buildings down and probably killed others. We've seen that over and over again, yet our advice does not include any mention of the fact that after the main shock's over, the danger has not passed. We need to be better about that as well. And like anything else in preparedness, watch for building construction and location. You know, when you walk into a theater, look for the exit signs. When you're getting on an airplane, count the number of seats to the exit. When you're checking into a hotel room, look for the stairwell. When you walk into a building in earthquake country, take a quick look around and see if it's unreinforced masonry. Is this a building that's safe? Where should I be getting out if it starts shaking? Because you will have no warning. And you know, just be prepared. I'll throw props out on this again. The Red Cross at some meeting, I had gotten one of those giveaways that you always get at those large meetings, and it was this almost paper-thin LED flashlight with a magnet that you put on your refrigerator. And I threw it in my briefcase, and I just had been there for about a year. When the power was out for a week and there was no electricity, no lights, no anything else, that flashlight came in really handy. I had carried it a long time just in case something happened, but always nagging in the back of my mind. Well, you know, nothing ever really does happen. But there you go. It happened, and that was a lifesaver. And that really brings me to the end of any prepared remarks, and went on, I see, longer than I expected. So I look forward to any conversation we might be having and any questions I might be able to answer. And as you're queuing up your questions, let me throw one last thank you to all of the men and women of Christchurch, Canterbury, the South Island, New Zealand, and all the international community that came to help. It was my honor to have seen and everybody in action and had the opportunity to help in whatever little way I could. So I look
forward
to your
question. Thank you very much, Tim. That really does give us a good sense of the event. The shots were just stunning, and like you, amazed there was not more loss of life than there was. All right, let's move on to our Q&A. And the way we do that is to submit a question or comment. You just click on Q&A from the top menu, and then you type your question or comment in the top half of the box that will open up. You can hit enter or click on ask. There is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you click on ask, your question does not immediately go to the bottom of the panel. It goes to an administration panel, which I will moderate. We ask you to please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, so you may enter your question or comment at any time, and I believe we have a few. We have a question from Joe Sukatska, who asks, how do commercial communications networks like telephone and cellular fare? Does New Zealand have a priority program for emergency managers and responders similar to GET and the wireless priority service? And if so, did that help?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, if they have something like GET, or I didn't see it being used, and I'm not aware of it, and I'm not sure they do. That's an interesting question. But generally, how did it fare? It really well. You know, when you look at that, the shot, if you noticed in the shot of the right after the main shock outside the airport, you see a number of people on their phones, and you know, I knew that my guest card wouldn't work there, and I also knew that the networks, if they didn't already collapse, were going to collapse soon. So I was one that helped collapse it by picking it up right away to call back just to leave a message somewhere that I was okay, that I'd survive in case, you know, it was going to break on the news. But you know, generally the networks held up. They brought in cows, cells on wheels that they never needed. It probably deserves a close look as to how it didn't collapse and how it was able to stay up the whole time. I can only point to, like the buildings that didn't collapse that were built to a building code that really only envisioned a 0.5G shake but survived somewhere around 2. The cell networks are a lot more resilient than we may give them credit for. That's all I can guess. But you know, I got a lot of fast busies, and I had to change networks from time to time to get a more solid signal. But there really was never a period of time that I couldn't get out. Even if I couldn't charge my phone, it generally worked.
Good deal. I have a question from Gary Singer, who asks, while at the Pinewood building, was there any shoring or bracing performed? How did the rescuers handle the aftershock?
Yeah, you know what? In that first few hours, no, not really. The first few hours was one of those scrambles to throw debris out of the way and get to the people they could, and it all transferred fairly quickly over that probably first 24 hours. Handed over to Urban Search and Rescue as it arrived. You know, there is a fairly robust USAR system in New Zealand. The Japanese National Urban Search and Rescue team showed up, I think, a day later. There was a Japanese language school in the CTV building, and unfortunately, all but one of those students were lost, and it was a big national tragedy for Japan, and they sent people immediately. All the nations sent people immediately, but I think they were like at a station and launched before they even called New Zealand. They were on the ground very, very quick, and it's actually not too far a flight. But when USAR started working, as USAR does, we saw it proceeded the way you would expect. When it was the construction teams, they were largely going after the people they could get at just by moving things out of the way. There wasn't a lot of shoring that I saw happening.
And I was going to ask, did the U.S. send a USAR team, or can you describe the kind of assistance that the U.S. provided?
Yeah, the U.S. sent a U.S. OFDA foreign disaster assistance team. One of our USAR system, it was California, I think it was California 2, Los Angeles County. That was the last thing I had to do. My last official act seconded to the U.S. Embassy and USAID was to go to the airport at, I think it was about 3 in the morning, and welcome the OFDA team and the California task force, hand over the mission to them, and then I went and got on a plane and came home. So I love those guys.
We can take some more questions or comments. I have one from Ava Jean, and she says, Tim, thank you for sharing your experience with us today. My question, are you aware of any research being done in New Zealand that may help us all with some of our planning, et cetera?
I know that the I apologize if I mistake the acronym, but the American Society of Civil Engineers, I believe it is. They're the Civil Engineering Professional Society. One of the learned societies has people had people there and are studying the building performance, so we can take any lessons there. I'm sure that others are as well. I know that the University of Christchurch has an emergency management program in their college-level emergency management education program, and I'm sure that they have plenty of lessons as well that they're going to share at some point.
Good. I do have this question from J.R. Jones, and she asks, it's a little bit off topic, but if I'm sure she was stimulated by the self-sufficiency of that art museum that became the EOC. She says, potable water is often a concern. What are health issues in drinking collected rainwater?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that is a good question. And even though I used to do water resources for a living, it's a little outside my area of expertise now. You know, I know across the West in New Mexico, a lot of people have done it. But in that particular location, I think they do treat the water. But I'll tell you, almost immediately, that whole time we were there, everybody was on bottled water and using, you know, your typical kind of disaster response. The pipes, everything was working, but there was so much infrastructure damage that the use of any infrastructure that may still be working was putting too big a strain on the system. So it was all the faucets, water was shut off essentially immediately, even though it might have still been working.
Thank you. We're at the end of our list of questions. I mean, you covered it. Oh, wait, I got one more for Mega Jean.
Okay.
She says, Tim, you mentioned lessons learned. What do you think is the single most important lesson or takeaway for you from this very personal experience?
I think the single most important takeaway is how we communicate risk to the public. I mean, my single most important takeaway as a professional emergency manager is how we go about public preparedness. What I mean by that is that we are pretty good about being consistent in our messaging. I don't know that we're self-reflective enough as a community. I'm working on that here, and we're all talking about that a great deal. But we say, you know, our primary preparedness message has been consistent: 3 days of food and water, a plan, and an emergency kit, and that's all important. We don't spend probably enough time on conveying what people need to do in the first 30 seconds to prevent getting killed. We focus our efforts on how do you survive, how do you try to, you know, not become a secondary victim, or how to be a modicum of comfort over a few days until things stabilize. We think we need to spend more time on our preparedness messaging, meaning what do you do when the ground starts shaking? If you're near an ocean and the ground starts shaking, run. You know, that kind of messaging. You know, go uphill. If you're in tornado country, you're a tornado, get to an inside room. That kind of message is probably more important than the stuff that we spend a great deal of time on. It's all important, but I think surviving the first instance is probably more important than the other.
Well, that's a good note to wrap it up on today. We thank you very much, Tim, for taking the time to be with us and share your perspective.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yes.
And
I'd also like to thank your staff, Rick Woolman and Viola Barnes, who assisted us in preparing the presentation today.
They're here, and they appreciate. We all appreciate what you're doing for the community, and we appreciate everybody who tuned in today to listen. Thank you for your commitment to emergency management and to all of our neighbors and and our families and all the people that expect us to do our jobs well. Your commitment by sharing and listening and talking to each other does that a great service. Thank you.
We did have a couple questions come in late. Let's just, if you're willing, would you just take one or two more?
Sure, I got about 5 more minutes.
Yeah, they just came in.
No problem at all.
All right, one moment. Let me bring this up. I should have waited just a little bit.
That's fine.
1 second. Okay, Viola, we just mentioned, she asked, did you see any different types of building materials that New Zealand used versus what is used in the United States? You mentioned the glass in one building that was still greatly intact after the second quake there.
Yeah, no, I didn't. The building stock looked identical. It was, you know, Christchurch especially was a 19th century port, kind of British colonial. It's pretty standard. I mean, downtown, walking around Christchurch, you could just as easily be anywhere in Europe or the northeastern United States.
And then we have Hank Straub, who asks, can you address the role social media played in getting messages out? You mentioned instances of people using text messages, but the Twitter-like systems play a major role.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was a huge, huge piece of the communications. It was all, text messaging, Facebook, Twitter, all those things were used constantly. I'll point out that the last person to be rescued, as I recall this happening, the last person to be rescued from a collapsed building, which happened, I think, 3 days after the quake, 3 or 4 days after the quake, had called for help and was communicating by text messaging on her phone. That's how she was able to get out. Nobody would have known she was there, and she certainly wouldn't have been rescued had she not been able to it's not necessarily social media so much, but that way of communicating. But it was her messaging that out, and then that message going out on things like Twitter and Facebook and through blogs that drew as much attention to it as it did. And so there are numerous great stories of that working.
And then let's just take this last one for Ava Jean, who asked, I'm interested in this whole community approach or concept now being emphasized. Would you say your perspective now plays into this very well?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, the whole community approach that Administrator Fugate and all of us here at FEMA have been advocating, it didn't come to us when we got here at FEMA. It comes to us from it's something that we believe in based on our long experience doing emergency management at the local level, at state level, working in the community and responding to disasters. It's what we've seen be successful, and it's what we see as a remedy to what we've seen that's not very successful. What I saw happen in Christchurch supports all of that. It was what we talk about happening, or what we presume would happen. I mean, it unfolded before my eyes, and it was, I got to say, a unique experience to be one of the survivors that Craig always talks about. And be one of those spontaneous volunteers. I've studied disasters like this my entire life. I've planned for and responded to disasters. It's the first catastrophic disaster I've lived through as a survivor on the street. And it reinforces everything we've been trying to do and say in the whole community, approach to emergency management. I'm just glad to be able to have the opportunity to help be part of advancing what we're doing and help protecting our public.
Excellent. Thanks again. And now we're going to move on just to a few quick announcements. Again, the video and audio recording should be available later this afternoon. And if you're not on our mailing list, just go to our home page to subscribe. And then before you run off, please take a moment to do this rating and review, which is just for relevance, and that will assist us in our future plans. New announcement, EMForum.org now has a page up on Facebook, and we're just learning how it works, so please bear with us as we get up to speed, speaking of social media. So please do stop by, when you have a chance. I do want to announce a new EIIP partner today, the Center for Disaster Research and Education at Millersville University in Pennsylvania, represented by Dr. Cepeda Yalda. Please do look them up on our partners page. And if your organization is interested in partnership, please do see the link on our homepage. Once again, thanks to everyone for participating today. Do enjoy your questions and comments, and thank you for them. And until next time, we are adjourned. Have a great day, everyone.